The essence of the Buddha Dharma depends on three legs to support it in a tripod structure, which is a very common Asian, particularly Chinese, model. One leg is the three characteristics, which is anicca, anatta, and dukkha, which means impermanence, no permanent self, and the nature of suffering or existential angst or lack of fulfillment, lack of contentment, however it's described. The second leg is the Four Noble Truths. That is dukkha, again, the same thing, suffering. Also, the origin of dukkha, the resolution of dukkha, and the Eightfold Path, the method to resolve it. And the third leg is paticca samuppada, which is the wheel of dependent origination, which means everything is connected. Those three things support the fundamental understanding of the Buddha Dharma. Without any one of those legs, the Buddha Dharma is no longer standing. This is what the Buddha taught. Now, that stands on the fundamental ground that's firm of an ethical and virtuous life based on the Panchasila, which is refraining from harsh speech, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from harming other living beings, refraining from entering into intoxicated states where you're out of control, and refraining from inappropriate sensual activities. And that doesn't mean just sexuality. It means eating, it means clothing, it means housing, it means everything that has to do with the sense world. And so if someone says they are practicing Buddha Dharma, but they only buy the most expensive items in the world, there's a conflict there, because they would not be living according to refraining from indulging in the sensual world. From a Buddha Dharma point of view, we're not making a value judgment here. We're not saying they're right or they're wrong, or they're ethical or they're unethical. We're saying that it's not according to the fundamental of what Dharma is supports Dharmic practice. Now, why do they say that? Okay, that's the second thing we're going to get into today before we get to jhanas. They say that because one of the very important aspects of Buddhist instruction, and we'll go into this also probably in the next discourse along with the dependent origination, is something called a rising and falling of a state. Now, we've seen that in the sutra we used last week, which we're going to go over again today. And that is the arising of healthy states, the support of the arising of healthy states, and the maintaining of the arising of healthy states, or the arising of unhealthy states, the activities that maintain unhealthy states, or the activities that can prevent the arising of unhealthy states, or the activities that can help us allow for the resolution and letting go of unhealthy states, and the activities that help prevent them from reoccurring. So if a person who wants to live according to Buddha Dharma spends a lot of time and energy in providing for sensual comfort, they are creating the arising of an unhealthy state which depends on sensual comfort. That unhealthy state will prevent other healthy states from arising. You follow me?
Yep.
And that is the fundamental role of Panchasila, to encourage the arising of healthy states, discourage the arising of unhealthy states. Now, living according to the Panchasila doesn't itself do those things, although somewhat contributes to it. It does those things in combination with the practice that are taught of Anapanasati and Satipatthana, which is breathing exercises plus the mental part of breathing exercises, which is the Satipatthana, which then will lead to, eventually, when practiced correctly, a state of jhana. You see, understand now where jhana? Jhana is the result of the practice, a meditation practice, a meditative practice. And jhanas are not exclusive to Buddhism, the Buddhist teaching, but the way the Buddha has presented it in Buddha Dharma, the four jhanas, is unique in how it's presented as comparable to other presentations of a jhana, which comes from Hinduism or Jainism or other meditative traditions.
Lauren, I have a question. I've read many of the books that you've suggested to me over the years. Is there any, because I've never read anything that has detailed this the way you're telling it to us this morning or today. Is this written anywhere, you know, that we can look at it and, or is this what, thank goodness for us that you have put together for us to help us understand it better?
This is, you're getting it straight from the source. It's never been written down this way. To my opinion, I've never encountered it in this way. I've read a lot of the different parts, but as I said at the beginning in my disclaimer of every discourse, and I said it this one as well, this is how it's coming in my, this is my understanding through my experience with all the different exposures I've had.
Okay.
Because for me, the one thing that allowed me to really fully embrace the Buddha Dharma and Bodhicitta, I should say, through my teacher was the practical application that made sense. And he presented it this way as well. And he never wrote anything either. The reason he never wrote anything was because writing something creates a karmic dependency.
According to him.
And once we create a karmic dependency, then giving ourselves an obstacle towards Nibbana, which is extinguishing of karma. So for example, when I lift a book and I read about someone who wrote about 800 years ago, and wow, that's beautiful. And I attach, I really like this author. Now arises a very interesting point of discussion. Karmically, what's just happened?
You've attached yourself to it.
I've attached myself, but have I also not allowed this person's karma to be free? And this is a big discussion that is very, I think personally, is a very valid discussion in the Vajrayana tradition from Tibet. You have all these great lamas, and you have them teaching their disciples, and they die, and then they come back, and they're reborn, they come back, and they have these cycles called Tulku cycle, reincarnation, teacher, student, and they teach great things. I mean, I love what I read, but it seems to me, personally, that there's an attachment to this process, and that is, in fact, a connection to karma preventing realizing full realization of Nibbana. Now, the counterpoint to that, often in my discussions with Tibetan lamas, and I've read in other places, yes, but part of our tradition, which is Mahayana, which is Bodhisattva commitment, is we're doing this until all other beings can become enlightened. So that's the Bodhisattva commitment. But you may recall in our discourse, I think it was two or three discourses ago, where in one of the sutras, the Buddha said that even a Bodhisattva still has these limitations. And so from some of the oldest writings in the canon, we see that the Buddha was not encouraging people to settle for the Bodhisattva state, even though he acknowledged it's a wonderful state. He was encouraging people to settle only for ultimate release, ultimate freedom, Nibbana. The Buddha did not say, I'm satisfied at where I am, and therefore I'm okay to be a Bodhisattva. The Buddha said, this method is for the ultimate liberation. You remember in the sutta last week, which we're going to go over in a little bit. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so are there any questions so far in what we've discussed? Comments, questions, thoughts?
No.
Everything's good?
Clear? Everything is clear, yeah.
Okay, so what I'd like to do... Yes?
Warren, all these... what you're saying, the teachings, are we trying to strive to live this way? Because it's like, we're to detach just from nice things, even not eating in a nice restaurant or even getting a nice pair of shoes that you like. It's just complete, total contradiction of the teaching. And, you know, where does that leave the normal person? I think I consider myself normal of, you know, wanting to have a healthy, balanced life and living the Buddha's life, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because... Or just to jump on that is that, you know, because of the kind of work that I do, you know, I mean, I basically deal with all wealthy people. And consequently, I have to, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk and look the look. So, and these are things I know that Quinn and I have discussed, you know, and I mean, I can't go into work at Bergdorf's and Target close. So I agree with Quinn, and there's a balance, you know, there's a balance, and there's an awareness that I find myself struggling with every day too, because I have to continue to be aware of that and not to be consumed by it.
I think the honest answer to that, and I say honest because I think it's very easy to give a dishonest answer. Oh yes, well, this is very simple. You try and find the best you can, et cetera, et cetera. That you'll get from any New Age teacher and from any Dharma teachers. The honest answer for that is the Buddha did not intend his teaching to be followed by the person who's participating in everyday actions in society. The Buddha offered his teachings for those who were going forth into homelessness, those who had reached, according to him, a level in their karma that realized that no matter how much one tries to spin it, this physical world around us is a delusional world. It has no ultimate truth or merit in the sense that one day the sun is going to explode, and that time the entire solar system is going to go one big candle. And everything that we think is important about how we should dress, how we should do, is absolutely of no significance. So then the question is, what is of significance? That's a good point. And from a traditional Bodhidharma point of view, what is of significance is Nibbana. And from, as detailed in the book that I suggested to you, Sam, What Makes You Not a Buddhist by Dzongsa Rinpoche, he says very clearly, and I agree with him very much in this, we can't even begin to understand what enlightenment is because it's so far beyond our own experience. We can experience the jhanas. Those are mental states of absorption. A jhana is a mental state of absorption, but it is not enlightenment by any means. It's a tool. Nibbana is a state that perhaps the closest definition I feel comfortable in presenting is a state of cosmic consciousness where all sense of the individual is gone, and all we have is awareness of the entire existence of what we want to call it, universal existence or natural existence or atomic existence or quantum existence. And it no longer in any way has any relevance to anything that is temporal. And so when a person in their conscious life, such as our lives or such as the Buddha, reaches this kind of state, that person has absolutely no need for clothing, for food, for anything. And this is one of the points I think that modern efforts through Mahayana and through modern Vajrayana and through modern secular Buddhist teachings, philosophy, gloss over when they present Buddha Dharma. That ultimately, as instructors of what the Buddha taught, we are leading towards a state of complete pure awareness of which nothing in our world has any relevance to it at all. And we'll find this a lot in the Zen writings. By Zen, I also mean the Chan writings of the Chinese Zen and Japanese Zen, where that is why practitioners go to a hut in a mountain and live there. They don't need anything else. That is why a bhikkhu, if you may recall, we discussed the question of picking fruit. Tiziana asked the question. That is why a bhikkhu, when he goes out or she goes out, a bhikkhuni, whether there's food in the bowl or there's not food in the bowl is of no consequence. What's of consequence is their mental state is calm and equanimity and accepting of whatever is the reality at that specific moment.
So is that how we live through this?
Here comes another question. Right, that's a very valid, the question being, well, how is one supposed to live? That's the bigger question. And I think that's a question each individual has to answer for themselves, how we want to live. Some people will say, I'm ready for the complete diving in. Other people will say, you know, I'm not quite ready for that. And in my experience, a very important part of one's life is being able to be honest with oneself and say, you know what, I really like this, but I'm not ready for that. So what can I take, and this maybe relates to your question, Quinn, more, what can I take that I can apply to my life now. I've made the decision, I like good food. I like nice clothes. I don't want to hurt people. I don't want to abuse people. I also like feeling good inside myself, in my own heart, my own emotions. I want to have healthy relationships, first with myself, then with those around me, then in my extended circumstances. So how do I balance all of that? And the answer to that is, well, you have to have a practice, some kind of practice. Well, what practice? Should I do Buddhist practice? Should I do Taoist practice? Should I pray as a Christian? Should I go to synagogue as a Jew? Should I become a Muslim? Should I go to Hinduism? I mean, should I become a shaman? Should I just take LSD and go through the flowers? Those are the questions. Those are just some of the resources. Should I become an atheist and follow only hard science? Everybody has to answer that for themselves. The validity of the answer depends on the ability for an individual to use the tools to verify what is real for them. Does that make sense?
So is it the real how we live our lives?
Well, this is
morals and ethics.
Yes, that's a big part of it. But this is what, for example, I mean, just to bring in, this is why I've started this whole website, Path to Wisdom, and not a website saying Buddha Dharma by Oren Ezra. The truth, I believe the truth, is in what the Buddha Dharma presents is ready for everybody, but not everybody is ready for the Buddha Dharma because the truth is not easy to practice. However, wherever each person is at, they can find a truth for themselves to practice. Do you follow me? And that's why it's a path to wisdom and not Buddha Dharma for everybody. It's not about selling a certain teaching. It's about encouraging people to find what and who you really are and where your heart is at. And once you know where your heart is at and who you are, you can then wisely and effectively choose a tool that will help you to live a good life, in the sense of a virtuous life, a happy life, a balanced life, an honest life. Does that make sense? And I think the tools that the Buddha offered can be used to do that. The tools, let me be more specific, the tools that the Buddha offered for ultimate realization can be used also to help us learn to know who we are, ourselves, our own heart. Because if you practice anapanasati and learn to breathe quietly, if you practice satipatthana and understand that I'm calming and where my perception, what's happening in my senses, what happens when I have emotions, what happens when I have feelings, you will start to know who you are. And when you understand those things, you'll be able to say, well, I like to tap in at that level. Where I am right here is great. Or no, I need more. Or no, that's a bit too much for me. Without feeling guilty or disappointed or judgmental in your own self. Because part of it is accepting, this is my karma where I am now in a healthy way, not this is my lot in life, which is a very, Judeo-Christian Abrahamic concept. Oh, this is my lot in life, so I have to suffer with it. That's not at all a Buddhist concept, a Buddha Dharma concept. A Buddha Dharma concept would be, this is the reality of my karma, I'm willing to accept it and be aware in each state and move towards clarity step by step by step as I feel is real. But remember, if we go back to several discourses, I've emphasized the knowing what is real is a skill. And that's a skill that can be developed. And those are the first skills that are developed in practicing anapanasati and vipassana and the different kind of breathing practices that the Buddha offers.